This is the Black Chisel Podcast. Real people, real experiences, real resilience. What I'm going to do is I'm going to introduce a good friend of mine, a gentleman named Bob Hunter. Bob's an interesting man, to say the least, and Bob and I have spent quite a bit of time together. Bob's the founder and he's the managing director of a consultancy known as Leader Ops, and that's his consultancy. And Bob does a lot of work in the whole leadership, the very high level risk management space, and also that of being a coach. Bob's got an interesting CV to go with, you know, and Bob's had 16 years experience in the military, and that was primarily in the SAS, and that was at a level of being a troop and squadron commander. He was in the parachute battalion, so he's silly enough to jump out of a few aircraft, which I don't really understand myself, but anyway, some people like it. He's been a UN military observer across operations in the likes of Cambodia, and he was a troop commander, unfortunately, for the very tragic Black Hawk tragedy that we had in 96, where unfortunately we lost many a great soldier. And he was heavily involved in the recovery of that. And I'll talk about that a little bit more as we go through. He's also, he led the management and the planning associated with the Iraq elections. And so, you know, we're talking about an individual he moved that ballot paper around, and well, that was a great risk to many. So ultimately, we're talking about an individual with just a wealth of incredible experience around the world, and equally back here in Australia. You know, he's the CEO of Rugby WA. In his spare time these days, because it sounds like he's got a heap of it, he's a surf life-saving coach. He's a rugby coach. He's, you know, he wasn't tough enough to play rugby league, but he likes that game, rugby union. You know, and ultimately he does some great things. And we're not just talking about a guy that's been at the soldiering side of things or whatever it be, and a level of business. We're talking about also a scholar. We're talking about a man that's a graduate of the Military of College in Duntroon, the University of New South Wales. He's got an MBA. He's a recipient of the Sword of Honour Leadership Prize. He's a graduate of the Australian Institute of Company Directors. You know, he's got a few bits and pieces. You know, it doesn't match my Cert 2 from South Fremantle TAFE, but he's doing all right for himself. So, mate, on that, morning, Bob.
Morning, Clay. Morning, everyone else. I hope you're all well wherever you are.
So, people, do me the honour, as you always do. Microphone's off for now, just so we don't get that background noise. And you can, cameras on or off, it doesn't really matter, but probably cameras off gives us a better visual of Bob. And then ultimately at the end, we'll get the opportunity to pose a question or two or whatever it needs to be to Bob. So I'm going to get straight into it. You know, Bob, these sessions are around, we like to talk resilience because, you know, you and I have spoke many a time, and the people that I engage with know that I'm very passionate around the subject because I see it as the proactive approach to going on this crazy journey called life. So when I say to Bob Hunter, with that wealth of experience you've got, just to segue in, when I say to Bob Hunter, resilience, what does that word mean to you, Bob?
Yeah, look, it's a word I think that gets a little oft overused and not necessarily in the right context in today. But if I hark back to early days, I grew up, my family father was a doctor, mum was the main family caregiver, but they were both immigrants out of the UK. So dad was a regional doctor, mum was the sole parent, had no family, had no support network. And I just saw a remarkable role model there of someone, and she epitomised it with this great expression, just get on with it.
Yeah.
And it was covering all sorts of things, whether it was the challenge of, you know, four young children under five, all of those environmental ones. But if I then carried that through into certainly early life in the military, it was epitomized by that little expression, just get on with it. Because resilience is, if we want to define it, we'll come up with some great words about you know, capacity to perform under pressure, to go again when it all seems a bit down, to lift yourself up when the going's a bit tough. So all of those elements come into it, I reckon, Clay.
I like that.
It's a simple expression, but you know, I can hear it still from my mum, and that expression, just get on with it. And you sort of go, you know what? I might as well just get on with it, because holding my head in my hands, sobbing into my tea, whatever it was, is not going to get it done. It's not going to fix it. It's not going to get us up again for the next effort. And that across sport, that across life, that across adversity, became a little bit of a sub theme, which I didn't necessarily appreciate as a younger bloke, but now I'm sort of, you know, worldly wise and old. Apparently I know stuff.
Bob, I like that, mate. It was James Flecker, the philosopher, that stated a little further, you know, when he spoke around the context of resilience, he just spoke a little further. And then others have taken that a step beyond that, and they've spoken of it's those one percenters that we need to habitually do day in, day out, to keep moving forward, because ultimately it's even promoted in a modern day that, you know, we can you know, not challenge ourselves to continue to push ourselves forward. We can sort of at times take the easier route, if you like. Now, bringing us into the military side of things, because, you know, I've got a fascination here, Bob, because and those that have listened to resilience sessions I facilitate, I always give very, very complimentary and respectful reference to the special forces and the military side of things, because, as I only said yesterday in a group session that I had, was my fascination is that apparently you're normal people, Bob. You know, I've met you. Others have met you, but apparently you're
short
normal people.
Short bloke with glasses, yeah.
And for everyone listening, there's a fun story. There was an image portrayed of Bob, or a perception, which we'll talk about later, but there was a perception portrayed of Bob by a particular someone that we had here at a particular time in the business, and I think they thought Bob was Dolph Lundgren from The Expendables. He wore a US bandana around the head, had a Bowie knife between his teeth, and ultimately was going to ride a Harley Davidson in here without a shirt on. Well, that sounds more like John Morley or someone like that, but it's definitely not you, Bob. You're a normal person. You're a father. You're not a grandfather yet, are you, Bob?
No. Just three young adults, yeah. all pursuing their own careers. So,
but I guess the point is, you're a normal person, Bob. You've got normal emotions like anyone else, right?
Yeah.
How did you do
it? And I think. And you want to refer that linkage to sort of, you know, this form of the word special forces. Mm-hmm. I think what that actually wants is people who have a capacity to firstly, you know, endure. You've got to be able to be physically fit, but it's not just short, sharp. You know, you're not doing a 100-meter sprint here. It's more like an ultra marathon, because you've got to still be going at the end of X days. You've also got to have some patience, because the model and the role, particularly of SAS, is long-range reconnaissance and information gathering, which means patience and not being discovered. It's not your war movie stereotypical kick the door in. There's a capability to do that, but that's only one part of the equation. So if you're starting to think of someone with a bit of endurance, someone who can go that extra kilometre, that team person who can work within, because small teams are always highly dependent on each other. You know, there's no backup coming from when you're behind an enemy line position. You've basically got to be able to look. So you've got a medic, you've got signals capabilities, you've got specialist demolitions and knowledge. So within that team of six people, you've got to be highly engaged, really clear, and work well with each other. You know, so if you put those parts together, then you start to go, okay, well, what do we want? Do we want a Superman? No, because they get a bit tired when they're going for, you know, long stomps of kilometres on kilometres. Yeah. And patience, well, we don't need a big ego with that, and working with a team. So if you bring all that together, you start to get a more rounded sort of person. And of course, there'll be your supermen, but they'll also have to have those other attributes to be able to work well contribute to a team, be clear that once the plan's set, you know, it's only going to survive the first shot, and then we'll be jumping into the, you know, plan B, C, D, E and F. But we'll have all thought through it. We'll have worked through that process, and we're really clear that our team is a highly synchronized unit. It's small, and then if you build that up, you then do more of those small teams. But the building block is that person.
So, and, Bob,
they're the attributes.
If I was to link that then as we talk about resilience, I mean, obviously, we spoke before, you know, about the need to just keep going forward, right? Just get on with it, just keep going. I mean, obviously, if you're a small team of six people that are heavily reliant on each other's performance and their optimum performance, right, because there's some real problem solving that needs to take place, ultimately, the resilience is going to be crucial because I guess you haven't got room for anyone just to put their hands in the air and say, you know what, I'm over this and I'm going to sit on the log for a while and I quit, so to speak.
Absolutely. And it's really important that, you know, everyone is clearly aligned to, and these are things I know we've talked about, and we do them corporately, you know, we have a purpose and a vision. Within those teams, everyone is clearly aligned to the purpose of. So, you know, we'll come across that one major resilience episode in my life in 1996 with the Black Hawk crash and the loss of 15 men from one squadron and three from the aviation regiment. But part of the resilience post that event was we were very, very clear on our purpose. And so our purpose, which was all about that counterterrorism and the saving the lives of the hostages, gave us a clarity of what we were doing, why we were doing that previously, and what we still need to be going forward. So that purpose was another crucial part to the alignment of team. Why are we doing stuff? One's sort of half in or half out. Everyone's really focused in on whatever the purpose and the mission and the task is, which goes into that linkage and planning, and everyone knows what's going on.
Bob, can I take advantage of that for a second? You know, when I talk resilience with people, I often talk about the need for us as human, and coaching for that matter, the need for people to establish a clear sense of purpose. So often people are waiting for an organisation or a business or something that to provide it for them. But what I do understand and appreciate that human without purpose has no truth north, so to speak. And so, you know, it's important for individuals, regardless of whether it's been promoted by a business or a team or other, to establish their own sense of purpose and mission, if you like, just to navigate through the complexity of life. Is that something you'd agree with, Bob? Is that something you'd give thought to? Now, Bob would appear to have frozen, or this could be a special forces tactic. I have seen it before. So, all right. Now, that's what they do, Brad Smallpage. This is what they call camouflage. So what we'll do is I'll continue to talk. This is what we had last week with Greg Cream. You'd think in 2024 we'd have a better capability, but unfortunately these things happen in the modern day. What I'm going to do is I'm going to continue the piece right now that I started about the sense of purpose, because Bob, I know this conversation because Bob and I have had it many a time, and it is crucial. It's crucial when we talk purpose that someone has a sense of understanding as to why they exist. Because at the end of the day, if we don't, we wander aimlessly, is to establish that. So let's say I work for a business unit here, as an example. As a leader, it would be important that I articulate, I share, I make it clear and concise as to why we exist. Now, people try to do that off a title alone. They try to do it off, well, our department's called X or our department's called Y. I think it's obvious. Well, it's not obvious, because this is a big logistical monster that has to achieve an outcome for a shareholder. So why do we actually exist? Because the question to pose back to oneself is, well, why wouldn't we just outsource it? Or why wouldn't we get someone else to do it? Or why would we not just do it a different way? So we need to ask, as a unit, why are we here? What is our value add? But that all being said, sometimes that might resonate strongly enough, or that might not be provided for us. So in the absence of that being provided for us, we need to then turn around and say, well, let's do that for ourselves. Let's establish that for oneself. So if I'm sitting here as an employee now, yep, on one side of me, I've got a position description, if you like, and some other bits and pieces. But ultimately, does that really tell me the ins and outs? Does it really tell me the real value add that I supposedly provide or should provide to the team, to the organization as a whole? And so that's one for us to discover. And that's where I do a lot of coaching work with people, because what I discover with all of us, male, female, alike, it doesn't matter. When we don't have a clear sense of purpose, we lose motivation because we really just wander. That's what we do. We wake up of a day and we wander and a little bit aimlessly. We don't really have a clear sense of self and what's most important to us and why we're doing what we do. I often use the easy referencing of saying things like, as a parent, you know your sense of purpose, because your sense of purpose is ultimately, I need to get out of bed now because I need to protect, I need to provide, I need to preside over. That's what I do. And so no, regardless how tired or loss of motivation there is, it's the purpose that moves me forward. Now, Bob Hunter, are you back?
Yeah, sorry, mate, I am.
Don't be sorry, Bob. I just explained to the team, and when you froze, right, because obviously when you're phoning in as you are from a tank or a Black Hawk, or let's even say the OBH Hotel in Cottesloe. When you froze, I said to everyone, I said, listen, that's what they do. This is stealth. This is what's called camouflage. I said, Bob's got this ability to sit very still. Bob, while you were gone, while you were putting another couple of 20 cents in the machine, mate, I was just continuing that purpose piece, because I was explaining the fact that our purpose is our own personal compass, right? Because without it, we just wander. Yeah. But having a clear sense of my value add, and I put it in an organisational context, Bob, because if people sit here to me often, they say, well, I don't have a job description. And I've often said, well, nor do I, and I don't need one, because I have a clear sense of where I add value. So that Bob, do you feel, aside from just the outfit providing that purpose, it's important for individuals to clearly understand that?
Yeah. And I apologise for dropping out there. Not sure what happened. It must be an age thing, you know, a bit older. The value of it, though, across everything, alignment to where you want to be is important. I know that I came back in on the end when you were talking about parenting, you know, one of those great jobs we take on, but we don't actually know what we're doing when we start it.
Mm-hmm.
We get pretty good as we go through it. And it's not dissimilar to other parts of our work. But if you think about other things you're involved in, and one of the places I've spent a fair bit of time in is in sports clubs. You know, sports clubs come together, and they're a modern form of a bit of the old village, the community.
Yeah.
Because they've got kids coming through, youth, you're aspiring young, you know, athletes, warriors, whatever it is, depending on the code of sport. You then got your guides, your mentors, your leaders, but you've got your sage, older, wiser people. But they're all very aligned to the purpose of that sporting club. And it might be to win a flag if it's a code like rugby or a competitive sport. But the other side to it is it's actually also to be a really good community that encourages and brings people in. So, you know, a couple of examples of the importance of purpose, but getting that right in an organisation can make such a difference, because people then know why we are moving in that direction.
Fantastic, Bob. Bob, I want to take advantage of that now that you're back as well, and circle back into the special forces side of things. I'm fascinated by the creed, "Who dares wins," and I want to understand what that really means from your perspective.
It's, yeah, look, it's a great one. It's a catchy one. It grabs you. And if, you know, on first read, you probably think that means we take chances, we do stuff that is on the edge, and if you don't, you know, you haven't got a chance of winning. If you take it back to where it originated, you know, originated when the SAS out of the Brit Army long range desert group, David Stirling in the deserts of Northern Africa against Rommel and his Africa Corps. So, same philosophy I've talked a little bit about, you know, small teams having a disproportionate effect, big impact. So a little bit of, you know, risk had to come in. But so those who dare had a chance of winning. But also it brought forward, well, you can't just send off a small team and expect to win each time unless you've really worked through what are the options, the plans, where are the vulnerabilities, where can you have the most impact. So there's a lot behind it. And that's the philosophy, all right? Well, we can do something with a small group. We can overachieve in an environment where they don't expect small groups to it. But the small group then has to be really strong in its team, has to have all its capabilities at top level. You know, if you've only got one demolitions expert, that one person's got to be good, or everyone's then also got to know enough to be able to help so that we can make it happen. So there's a mindset there about having an impact, but there's then a coherent team and a lot of planning that goes behind it. You know, the old movie version where all of those military types, usually in singlets with big guns in the back of trucks, sit there and say, yeah, 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 and then this complex plan unfolds. You know, magic things happen and you just go, wow, that's pretty cool, just off, you know, three words. But the reality is behind all of that and behind that mantra, who dares wins, is a lot of teamwork, planning, alignment to purpose, clarity of what you're doing. So while it sounds catchy and, you know, just take a chance and have a go, it's underpinned by all those other elements. So that becomes a methodology. That's how we work. That's how we live.
Great, Bob. Great. That's completely different understanding from a good self, because I guess I'd form that initial understanding or that view, I guess, that, you know, who dares wins, mean roll the dice and just go for it sort of thing, you know. So it's a lot more to
You've got to take chances. Yeah. You've got to take chances sometimes. But, you know, risk and risk management is a balance of, all right, what's the likelihood this will happen? What's the consequence? You weigh them up and then you have a go. And, you know, some people will have a go at have a higher risk appetite than others. I think it's fair to say. I probably grew up doing that. Anyone who's stupid enough to jump out of perfectly good aircraft.
Yeah.
Is an example of that. But again, you know, there's a whole bunch of training behind that.
Yeah, yeah.
There's equipment surety. You know, the people who pack your parachute, you've got to have a real trust in that. You've got a reserve chute, but when you jump from 1,000 foot, there's not much time to pull that little baby if things go wrong with the big one. But again, you're trained, you're prepared, you've got a whole bunch of planning and preparation under your belt before you take that risk.
And Bob, that's a piece I want to talk about. You know, like, so when I talk to people about resilience, you know, the definition I like to use, and I think you and I've had this discussion, I talk about extracting the key elements from the American psychological definition, which is loosely, you know, articulated as the ability to cope, the ability to emotionally and mentally cope, in turn the ability to adapt, which equates to the ability to problem solve. And then in turn, the ability to grow stronger from the experiences had, meaning the threshold now increases for the next events that follow, meaning we get stronger based on our life experiences where we choose to embrace those scars. So the piece I want to grab off that is twofold, is that when you're in the Special Force, I remember you spoke to me early in the piece and when we very first met, and you said something along the lines of, and this is how I interpreted it anyway and held on to the thought, was, from the moment you went in, you trained, to the moment you left, you trained. And a lot of people in the industry that we operate in, you know, it's a bit of a one and done. You know, I did this years ago, or I did one of these, or I've been on a leadership program, or I carry an MBA with me, or I once did a resilience program, or I am resilient. But my understanding in the playgrounds that you've operated, Bob, is that no, we've chosen you and selected you based on what you've shown, the qualities that you've shown, but now the work starts and we start to develop your mindset, we develop your problem-solving skills. But from memory, you also spoke to me that continues till the day you walk out the door. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Like there's obviously a benchmark process to be selected through what is a very rigorous process in selection, whether it's soldier or officer, it doesn't really matter. But once you're there and you get through that hurdle, then there's another one. Then there's more development, there's more advancement. And you just got to think about, and particularly over the last 20 years where they've been involved in continuous conflict in places like Iraq and then Afghanistan, where the consequences are clear and real. You get it wrong, people get badly hurt and die. So the mindset, and it was always summed up, you know, you'll see the various sort of movies and they've got the grisly old former operator who's the trainer. And there was a fabulous gentleman in my training and development young officer days, one officer, Joe Van Droffman, and he had a fabulous little startup, but he was as hard as nails. And his mantra, which everyone adopted and uses, was the only easy day was yesterday. And that mindset pervades through things like courses and training activities, because if you're not testing yourself in that environment, when the real thing happens, you know, you've done a lot of Tuesdays and Thursdays, but suddenly Saturday comes along and we're not ready for it because we haven't tackled in training, we haven't, kicked the clutch goal or whatever it is. So that mindset, I think, pervades through both the organisation, special forces, the military in general, but I know special forces, it becomes part and parcel of pressing an envelope, you know, living that little mantra of if we don't press the boundaries, we won't be able to then adapt and adjust. Because remember, the military are training for a two-way shooting range.
Yeah.
But they are training to have an opposing force that is trying to disrupt you. Now, you know, MINRES has competitors and some environmental challenges and, you know, others within the thing who, you know, you can often portray as not being part of the help solution. But what you don't have is an enemy actively trying to disrupt you. So you've always got to have that mindset that whatever you train for and prepare for, it's potentially going to be worse than we expect, and not expect, you know, the nice easy option one, which we all want to happen. You know, you can start going on option one and happy days if it stays in play, but as soon as option one, you know, the old punch in the face or the first shot, we adjust and change plans.
I like the take on that as well, Bob. I think I heard that when I met your colleagues or your friends in the Pronk Boys there, where they said the enemy gets a vote. I thought that was a good piece as well that sits behind it.
It's very democratic, you know. there's a bunch of stuff going around the world, and again, you know, having worked in a strategically focused organisation, you know, keep abreast of what's going on. But again, you can see small disproportionate impacts, so the Houthi rebels in Yemen impacting global trade because they've got some weaponry and an attitude to really stuff things up. So, you know, there is an enemy option there happening that is very hard to deal with. So it's, you know, that's, I guess, a little bit of an analogy, but it's a clear and present one that's having a global ramification.
Bob, you just spoke of your old drill trainer, or whatever the term is to be correct, being as hard as nails and having that old approach, the only easy day was yesterday, so on and so forth. But I do also recall a conversation with you once about the modernisation of some of the approaches to your training in the modern day, where the neuroscience has been introduced, so to speak, and things like that. Can you give me some insight into that?
Yeah, look, I think that the beauty of, you know, that mindset around the only easy day, you know, that was pretty old school. And a number of the other senior trainers, back in the 90s, was that they had an experience out of, you know, that last conflict at that time, which was Vietnam. So they were very much clear on the consequence if you didn't get it right. But then one of the things around the SAS is, and special forces in general and the military, is always looking for that next advancement. And it might be technology and it might be equipment systems, but it's also around that core ingredient, which is the person.
Yes.
And the person, the peak, you know, we talked a little bit about, you know, your stereotypical view is, you know, it can look quite normal, not a massive unit, all that sort of stuff. But again, the person and one of their key attributes, which makes a smart soldier, capable soldier of working at strategic levels, is capacity to think through, intellect, and engage. So there's always going to be advancements in that. The tracking and the measurement, the analysis of how people handle stress. There's always this ongoing development. So having not been in there for a wee while, I can't talk specifically on what today's practice is, but I know it is ongoing and advanced. And part of that also ties back into, you know, there's a big investment in the person, Clay, to get them through selection and then once they're trained. So you don't want to lose that asset, you know, prior to their time. So the longer people can be, you know, kept well, mentally sustained, the better it is, you know, because inevitably conflict, we've seen a lot out of, the extended period that teams spent in a very, very nasty war in Afghanistan, is then the mental issues that come with repeated exposure to conflict. So trying to manage all of that, it's not just about the physical, it's not who can lift the heaviest weights or shoot the straightest, longest. It's also about their well-being, their ongoing capabilities.
I love that, Bob. I mean, that's my favourite piece out of, you know, or lesson, I'd suggest, from time spent with your good self and interest in your former playground was that piece. You know, like I do have a gripe, I'd say, in the industry that we operate in here, in that, you know, like I said earlier, that false security that people adopt where, you know, well, mate, I've done a leadership program. You know, when I was at such and such back 10 years ago, I did a leadership program, or, you know, or I just know this stuff. And you know, like I always say to people, who's feedback? You know, because if it's your own feedback or your mother's, you probably need a third source. You know, and I've liked that saying that I learned from another party, which was, you know, skills kill fears. And it's that ability to have these sharp, current, effective skills so I can lead. I look at you, Bob, and I look at your past, and I look at your CV, and I look at even the learning that you've undertaken at a formal level from an academic perspective. But the Bob that I know, the age that you're at now, Bob, you're still a continual learner in this space. You're still a learner in the whole leadership, resilience space and everything else. Is that fair to say?
Oh, look, I think you've got to have that energy to keep, you know, learning and adapting. There's nothing sure than that the world will change. You know, Darwin said that all the way back through, that those who will adapt and adjust are the ones who will survive.
Yes.
But that continual learning, you know, look, I saw that in my parents as a role model. Dad was a doctor, but that profession demands that you continually learn. So, you know, it was epitomised there from a profession that said you continually learn, you know, new technology, new medicines, new capabilities. So, you know, that profession demands it. So I've seen that in that. But there's, why would that be not applicable to any other profession? You know, the world around us adjusts. You know, when I started working computers were very much an emerging thing. But look at us now. You know, we can't live without them. And being able to learn and adjust.
Well, you haven't learned enough or adjusted enough watching your technology skills earlier. I mean, I might get Mark Dawson to provide you some mentoring. But, mate, what I'd like to do, I'm conscious of the time, right? Because, I'm conscious we've got about a good solid 20 minutes left and there's a piece I want to get to. What I don't want to do is go into the detail of the event, so to speak, because you've had to live that way too many times over, and people that are interested can definitely do the web search and understand a little bit more around that very unfortunate event of 96, the Black Hawk tragedy, that you're the squadron commander of. What I want to talk about is your recovery from that. What Bob did, who helped him, how he did it, how Bob... Yeah. Went from such a tragic, traumatic event and being the leader of to being the man that Bob is still today. And given the work that you did after that, you know, to be able to do that recovery in 72 hours, to then go on and do all sorts of other things and continue to jump out of things and so on and so forth. So that's the piece I'm interested in, Bob. What did Bob do to keep moving forward?
Yeah.
As his mum would have said, get on with it.
Look, there are a couple of building blocks to it, and I know you've spent some time with the brothers Plonk and Tim Curtis around this concept of a shield in a number of layers, and I've always talked about it in very similar terms around the layers. So I'll dot point them so it's pretty clear. The first was, as an organisation, we had very clear purpose. That's what capability need to. We then had a strong team. So the regiment also brought people in to help with that work purpose. But then the next bit was around family in so many different levels. My wife, look, unbelievable support, stalwart. You know, she was pregnant at the time, so we were going through a whole bunch of all of those emotional things. But then to still hang in there is just unbelievable. But then the wider sense of family, you know, workmates looking after the families of buddies and mates who had been killed. But then the wider family of the ex-regiment members coming together and the starting of things like the Resources Trust, which then helped provide additional funding. So, you know, that cascading sense of family and that you weren't in it alone was unbelievable. And then people coming back to me, this is what I had an experience of and so on and so on. They were all really important. And then on a personal front, you know, for me, just trying to make sure I had activity and still did a morning fitness and a range of things that just focused a little bit on me and allowed me to still be fit and healthy in order to do those other work things. But the final bit, and this is where, you know, I didn't perhaps appreciate it at the time, was a connection to others, and it was a connection through a sports club. People who weren't in that workplace. So it wasn't all just like people, you know, giving a giddy up and an attaboy support. It was a wider group of people who didn't work in that place, but we had a connection through, and it's from my rugby club, for example, where, you know, there was wider support and there was also a sense of, you know, other lives and normalcy despite all of this chaos and turmoil that was swirling around in that other workplace, you know. So a bunch of subtle layers. I know Tim and the resilience was talking about it as a shield and different parts to that. But they were the bits where, you know, at the time I didn't necessarily know that. You know, we had some professional support. You know, people, no one goes throughout that without some form of traumatic stress. At the time it was called disorder. But to me it's just post-traumatic stress. We're all going to have it at some stage and at different levels. It's how you then use those frameworks, those couple of other things I spoke about, purpose, the team, family, health, well-being, and then, of course, you know, your wider connections. But they were the bits that I've reflected on over time that all helped and drove me forward, and always had a, you know, well, I'm going to be the best at whatever I can be. And they were my, you know, sort of purpose aspirations.
Bob, I was hoping you were going to say that. And I have had this conversation with you, so I was across some of how that was going to come out. But, you know, one of the things I continue to talk about here, and it's one of the chapters that we work to as the coaches across the business and support with, is the importance of tribe. Because I keep reminding people that no one has ever survived this on their own. You know, the current race of human being that's on this planet is here because of our ability to come together, work together, to build society, and so on and so forth. And it's very common, I guess, to continue to see people day in, day out that are battling and struggling with different things, and simply saying, yeah, and you say, what support mechanism have you got around you? What do you do for your resilience? Whatever else, mate, I do it myself. You know, like, and that belief that resilience is just a pure, you know, it's toughness. I'm just going to do it myself. And I'd argue it's a bit of stubbornness as well. But all I heard when you spoke then was the importance of tribe and various different tribes, from the rugby club to family tribes to the military tribe to so on and so forth. But clearly that connection, yeah, as you said, with the other people is the key piece. Whereas, again, my experience too often in this industry is that people feel that they just need to do it themselves.
Yeah, but and that's, you know, some of the mantra and bits around, particularly if you've got some leadership responsibilities. Well, I'm the leader, I'm supposed to do this. If you take another approach, instead of it being about me, it's actually about we. You know, how do we get through this? Because, you know, particularly in 1996, there were a bunch of hard, capable, smart soldiers going through real hurt, emotional hurt, lost best mates, families, lost fathers, partners, of, you know, their spouse or long-time husband. So there was so much going around, but because there was a capacity for everyone to sort of understand it as a bit of a group and share, invested it. It wasn't all just vested in me. It was we. And I think that is a bit of a mantra, is how I've seen always sort of been approached, you know, what's good about your team? You know, can you be better, the sum of your parts? It's not just about you individually. So people don't have to go off and take that on and say, I must solve it. You know, it's weakness in me if I can't. It's actually the other way around. If you don't recognise that and think I can be better with the team and helping others, get very lonely and, you know, isolated.
Bob, I'm a big fan of the term, and my interpretation of, or how I like to use the term, that of role model, right? And what I mean by that is I use the word role model in the context that, you know, people that I could look up to, people that I do look up to and respect, people that I could aspire to be like, so on and so forth. And what I mean by that is, when I had my unfortunate event last year where I went upside down, had a little stroke, you know, I lay there in the hospital and I started to do my research, and I was trying to find someone that I could, you know, respect as a role model that had been through something same, if not similar. And to look at that as a pathway forward. Does role modeling, you know, in that regard play a role in your life? I mean, is there people that you've looked up to, Bob, that have helped you get through things, that you've inspired to be like? Because, you know, you're very much a role model to the likes of myself. So is that something that's played a role in your life, Bob?
Oh, look, I think so, and at different times it'll have more relevance. Like, it might be, you know, when I transitioned out of the middle, you know, out of the military, I sort of really only knew one thing. I didn't really understand commercial. You know, we knew we could do security risk management with our eyes closed in a range of tough places, So then trying to find someone who could help me with that transition from what is everyone would see military is very structured, but I think some of the things I've spoken about, special forces, it's not actually, it's multiple plans, it's capabilities. So transitioning to commercial. So, yeah, there was a couple of role models that helped me with that. And then when that sort of evolved, then I wanted to learn something or do something else. There were a bunch of people who helped set that, a benchmark. Where was I trying to get to? But importantly in that, and this is another little bit that I think often gets missed, is the value and the importance of history and experience. You know, most of these things have happened before. We don't actually need to relearn them all again, and some of them are articulated in history documentation and others are in, you know, people who sort of can give you that experiential thing. So we often miss the value of that. But in terms of whether it's people or use of experiences, that modelling is an important part. Just not quite sure what my role model is, you know, currently and ahead of me. So I'm aspiring to find one of those. But
something, yeah, it's just an interesting point for me, Bob. It's just a piece where I think it's another form of beacon, right? It's another form of true north, and it's not to try to emulate, replicate, or imitate anyone else. It's, you know, you've got to be your authentic self, but it just gives you what you just suggested. It gives you a level, it's like the mentoring component. It gives you a level of experience that sits in front of you, and you can learn from that and you can gain from that without necessarily having to hit all the bumps on the way. So,
and the other part is, please, it can also be inspiration, Clay. It can also be inspiration. Right, I'm here. I think that's where I'm here. I want to get to there. How do I get there? You know, again, where am I stepping to? To me, you know, life is an upward climb. You know, we're always trying to get to another place, whether it's financial security, well-being as a family, you name it. How do we keep advancing?
Bob, I think I'm going to jump across again because we've got a bit of time left, but I definitely want to just grab on a couple of bits and pieces that I think, you know, people listening in, my good self included, can grab onto a bit. You know, you're on a mission, so to speak. Let's call it that. You're on a mission. You're in the desert of whether it be Afghanistan, Iraq, border of Pakistan. I don't know, right? But you're on that mission. It's been a long time away from home. It's been a long time. It's been tough. Things aren't going well. You're tired. You, for that matter, you've had your last, you know, ration or whatever it may well be. You're hungry. It's tough. They're starting to get some conflict amongst the small team. You know, what is, you know, thinking about some of those situations, what has Bob used? I can appreciate everything you've shared to this point, but what has Bob used for himself sometimes to just say, Bob, get your shit together? How do I just get my shit together? You know, because I appreciate everything about the purpose and the mission and the values and all those different things, but sometimes it's just that moment of being an absolute human thinking, Jesus, I just want to tap out on this.
Yeah, look, we're all going to experience that at different points. And again, depending on all of the environmental and the circumstances. But I guess it just comes down to that inner drive, play. You know, what I want to be. All right, I'm not going to let this beat me. And I think, you know, that in part and parcel is something that's really drawn out of you as part of a process where Special Forces or SAS, that selection course, because you are thrown into all of those circumstances.
Gotcha.
You're at the end of your physical tether. You are told that you're doing 20 kilometres and there's a time, and if you don't do it in that time, you fail. But you don't go, you go through a 20-kilometre mark and you don't know it, but it's 22 kilometres. And, of course, you know, your time's wrong. So they're always throwing these things at you to test this bit, but this bit. And I keep going. And I guess that's just, you know, part and parcel of a personal drive and motivation. I've always sort of had that mindset, whatever it is, right, I'm getting through that. It's not going to beat me. If it beats me, I will go and, you know, check in, find another way next time so it's not going to beat me.
Bob,
I guess that's just part of our inner drives. And most of that comes from up here.
Would it be fair to say that it's your inner drive, Bob, but it's also all that training, all that practice, all that exposure, all that experience also coming together in the moment. It's that threshold that's been created.
And it's, you know, it goes that little, I know it's pithy, but the only easy day was yesterday. Now, yesterday wasn't too bad. It wasn't quite as hot as the previous day, but, you know, it's just a little mindset, right? So what are we doing? What are we doing going forward? And I think that's in everyone, and we do it in different ways, and in some things we'll do it more, you know. I thought I could try and play golf a while back, but that's got the better of me.
Bob, I'm a green kid by trade, mate. You want to be careful of that game, golf. It can be quite dangerous at times too. There's some old vets and the like out there that they love hitting a golf ball upon you. So, mate, question. What do you say? What would you say right now? It's only a short question, short answer, I'd imagine. But, you know, you've got the victim psychology, right? You've got the individual that throws their arm in the air and they say, mate, why me? Poor me. No one ever told me. You know, and you see that a lot in business, right? You see that a lot in business. Oh, I can't move forward today because no one told me, or poor me, or they don't give me enough of this, or they don't give me enough of that. I mean, you and I have spoke about times where you guys doing the tactical component of what you do, it doesn't necessarily have the same level of understanding being shown by those, let's call it, in the White House, pressing the button and telling you to do it, right? So, you know, if I was saying to you right now, Bob, what would you say to someone if they started putting their arms in the air and saying, why me, poor me, no one ever told me, and I haven't got enough of this? What's your response to that?
Yeah, I think it's that whole, what can I control? And the only thing I can control is my emotions and how I respond to that, because everything else is beyond my control. I can put energy to it, but if I just go back in and say, all right, what can I do about this? No. How do I need to respond to it? How do I control my, you know, it's that spheres of influence, Clay. I know you're big on that in some of your content pieces. Because if you follow up on the victim and, as you say, throw your hands in the air because you're worrying about things they can't control, that it'll just cascade downwards. Whereas if you say, right, in this sentence, I can only control how I respond to it, right? I don't need to be happy about it, but there's no point in me shouting and screaming and abusing other people. Keep calm, set a good example, help them control their emotions, influence them as best I can. But it all comes down to, you know, if you can't control it, don't lose emotional energy over it.
Bob, before we start to wind things up and give people the opportunity to ask you a question, you know, if there was five things, the number's irrelevant, but if there was five things, three things, four things that Bob Hunter, sitting here today with all that wealth of experience and life, but sitting here today as you are at the OBH Hotel or whatever it be, what are the five key things to support one's resilience?
Yeah, look, I think be clear what it is you want to do. What's your core driver purpose? You know, I've told you before, I love that. Of this sort of team coaching workshop space, because I know I'm sharing both learnings, formal learnings and experience. So that to me is a bit of a purpose. But also then being as good as I can be around, you know, the core roles, family member, and contributor around, you know, home and house and family. But also then, you know, okay, so what am I learning? What am I growing? I think in today's digital society, if you don't take an effort to find a variety of things, you know, you'll just get fed more of the same stuff and you're not actually learning then. You're not actually expanding and taking a view of wider life. So, again, that continual learning and aligning it to your purpose and your core around family. They're big things for me.
Good on you, Bob.
Because if you're doing those things, then you're going to keep growing and evolving and not just sort of sit with, I just get plenty of this, which just feeds the stuff I like. I'm not understanding it on a wider basis. I'm not going to be a great citizen, and I'm just going to continue this polarisation that goes on across levels of our society.
Great stuff, Bob. Well, Bob, what we're going to do is I'm going to come back online because there's a couple of minutes. This is, you know, well timed. There's a couple of minutes left, but we've got a lot of people logged in this morning, and I'm sure there's a question to be asked. And people, please take advantage of the opportunity to ask Bob a question. And it doesn't have to be a complex question; it'd be a pretty straightforward question. You know, it might be, you know, what's your fitness routine, so to speak. It might be, you know, and I've got the answer to that. Bob loves to don a bit of lycra and do a few calisthenics on the beach of Cottesloe. Fantastic. Quite the supple creature. He's a supple leopard. So people...
Clearly, because I'm sitting down, we're getting a great impression on that.
Mate, it's incredible what AI can do for us, right? So,
Isn't it?
What we'll do, people, come back online and someone lead in with a bit of a question for Bob. Introduce yourself and just lead in with a question for Bob, if you don't mind.
Bob, how are you? Good, thanks, mate. That's great. Great to see you, mate. Fantastic. Loved it. Bob, what got you into this, I guess?
Good question, because when I joined the Army as an 18-year-old, that wasn't really in my mind. First hurdle was to get into Duntroon Officer Training School, did that 4 years, and then to graduate from that. So next hurdle, graduated, and then into the infantry battalion, which was a parachute one. And it was probably there or in the latter years where I'd seen people training for SAS. So it was where's the next stepping stone or challenge or opportunity? And, you know, quite simply, the best soldiers would apply for that and the officers. So it was about an aspiration, a goal to be as good as I could be. And then understanding that, then doing the training and the preparation, all of which, you know, was the plan to get there rather than, I just wanted to go. So it built up over time, as opposed to, you know, a burning ambition as a 10-year-old. Well, I did read a fair few, you know, Commando War comics as a kid.
Okay, thank you very much.
Who else? Who else has got a question for Bob?
Hello. Bob, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Good, mate. Really, really enjoyed that. Bob, one of your biggest challenges to date in life, and how did you navigate through it?
Sorry, what was the biggest challenge, Gareth?
One of your biggest challenges in life, and how did you navigate through it?
Yeah, okay. I guess I've alluded a little bit to it, but the biggest challenge was that accident. And the loss of 15 men. So being the commander in the spot and then a helicopter just behind, there was a massive form of that. But the flow on from, you know, the death of those 18 men and crashing of two choppers was then the inevitable review and accountability. So the biggest challenge for me was a board of inquiry that went for 6 months where every act, action, inaction was questioned. So it had myself, the commanding officer, who was my boss, myself, and then my opso. And we were the three literally in the dock. And that challenge of continually having everything you had done retrospectively reviewed, second guess, was most challenging. So dealing with it and navigating through it was, again, a bit of support. My boss was outstanding, mainly officer at the time, Mike Silverstone, a friend to this day, but a highly respected colleague, had my back. So I knew my boss had my back. We were given support by a highly capable QC, Mr. Len Robert Smith, who was just outstanding. But it demonstrated to me the importance of details, notes, records. For those who've seen me in action, I do coaching. I navigated through it, and I now have a OneNote database from heaven, I call it, and it's got everything I've ever taken on board over the last decade. It's only a new thing for me in that respect, but it was about that. And so that was the lesson for me, because there was accountabilities, I had responsibilities, but I also had to be able to justify and validate what I had done. There's a fair bit in there, Gareth, but that was the hardest point of my life because of all those other things going on as well. But then to be, you know, chest poked, questioned on everything you've done, That was the methodology. If I hadn't done it then, I learned to be doing it thereafter.
Thank you.
Anything final?
Hey, I've got one question actually. Sorry.
Please.
Hi Bob. It's Mike here. Pleased to listen to your fantastic performance. I'm just interested thoughts on this with people coming from the military, a long period of time in the military, coming out of the military and then going into normal life, if you like, a normal working environment. I'm not going to say I've had issues with people in the past, but I have come across people who struggled to sort of adjust to that normality. Leadership in a mining company, for example, as opposed to leadership in the military. The basic fundamentals are the same, but you're in a different environment.
Yeah. I think, Mike, if I take it back, one of the things when you join service of any form, Army, Navy or Air Force, let's say Air Force, but certainly the Army, you are fundamentally schooled, drilled, trained, indoctrinated, whichever way you want to, in the importance of core values, how you act and behave. You know, if one person's late, everyone's late. So you are built into that series of values-based actions and behaviours no matter what level. So you live in that environment all through your military. So fundamentally, someone joins, recruit, officer, whatever it is, they always have that as an underpinning process by which you serve in the military. Because remember, military is about service. You're not there about a high dollar value. So with those two pictures, and you take someone out of that environment into an environment that perhaps is more commercially aligned. It's a bit more dog eat dog. You've got to do this. And I'm not talking mining in particular, but it is an example of it. They struggle in that. Some adapt well and weave through, but that can be where people can struggle in the transition from the military because those things aren't quite as clear and apparent. So good teams have those. They have good values, you know, how we act and behave, and they're clear on their purpose as a team, not just their business purpose. So people can adjust if they get an environment like that. And so it can work both ways. You know, the commercial environment helping an ex-military or a veteran to transition, you think about those things. Right? What is the purpose? How do we act as a team? And how strongly are our values and behaviours incorporated in how we live? And they will then jump in and become a valued contributor. And the other way around, they can be a good role model to help teams who aren't perhaps as strong in that. But yeah, it is a common trait, and I've always put it down to the fundamental difference between one life, a service life, than a, you know, perhaps a more commercially driven life.
It's a good perspective. Thanks, Bob.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. Good answer. Thanks, mate.
All right, so people, we'll wrap it up. It's 8:05, and we've still got, you know, a massive contingent on it. I know that, you know, all of us have got big days ahead. So, again, thank you very much. Massive thank you to Bob Hunter. Those of you that know Bob, appreciate everything we've just listened to, and those that you haven't have probably valued that equally. And so make yourself known to him when he's here, and great guy. So thanks very much to Bob Hunter.
Thank you, Clay.